So the ground rules for this really are just questions from the audience. It can be questions between speakers. If the speakers want to begin by posing questions to each other or objections to each other, that's certainly permitted, or we can just go to the audience right away. I mean, we want to keep it sort of in the general domain of Thomistic philosophy or philosophy in general that we're in the realm that we're talking about. But it doesn't have to be strictly related to a question or to a presentation that we've given today.
Yeah, exactly.
We want to start with questions for Dr. Hochschild because he has to, unfortunately, leave soon. So get your questions into him now. Yes, please.
I have a question for Dr. Hochschild. My question is about participation and how participation fits into the schema of the two concepts of analogy. So I know the text isn't meant to be exhaustive, but one text I was thinking about in particular is Thomas's commentary on the divine names, in which he says that divine wisdom is actually the cause of created intellects through some participations of similitude, not proportions of similitude, but participations.
Right.
And I know that you mentioned Father Gregory Rocha's book in your talk on the concept of knowing God,
yep,
and positive and negative theology. He says that a creature participates in God through its perfections, because God contains all the perfections of creatures super eminently,
yep,
but proportionately in God according to the limits of their nature. So in that sense, could we actually say that there is a way in which a creature's similitude to God is the sharing of a property through participation?
That's a great question. Well, it is and it isn't. It's a sharing of a property, but it's not because there's some common thing that's equally inhering in them that would sort of put them in the same species or genus. So I don't develop this argument in the paper. I hint at it, and I talk about it a little bit in another paper, but it's something that I'm convinced is worth exploring. I think the notion of participation always implies for Aquinas the four-term proportionality schema. So when he says that one thing participates in another, I think it's always an implication of that, that there is something in the one that is to something else in that one, as something in the other to something else in the other. But I would have to argue for that.
Can I just ask you to give an example? The first thing that comes to my mind is, so this is a theological question, participation in the divine nature. So Aquinas does have an account of how we have a likeness of God, and we can grow by grace in that. What are the four terms?
So particularly to the extent that we are the imago Dei, right, which would, presumably every creature participates in God, but we have a special participation in God. So there's something about God that is reflected in us, or that we represent in a way that other creatures don't, and that's typically cashed out in terms of the Trinity, right? So an Augustinian account of that might say, okay, so in God there is this relationship between the persons of the Trinity that is reflected in us in the relationship between intellect, memory, and will, for instance. That's just a quick example. So
like,
that would be a six-term analogy, right? You got A is to B is to C, as X is to Y is to Z, but that's the same.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, if you say that faith, you know, gives us a sharing, a kind of increased a growth as you grow in faith and charity, you grow in your sharing in the divine nature. What is that? So I understand.
Right.
What is that in compared to in us that is compared to, you know, as X is to Y in God?
That sounds to me like a special case of how we talk about knowledge in God as a reflection of knowledge in us, right? So faith is a supernatural knowledge. It's a perfection of our intellect. So it is a perfection of our power to grasp the truth that is in us in some way like, but obviously in lots of ways unlike, the way God has an intellectual power by which he perfectly knows himself. Of course, the reason it's so different is that all those things I just talked about in God are the same thing, right? God, the object of his knowledge, his act of knowing, all of that given the doctrine of divine simplicity, are the same, but we learn something about it through the schema of proportionality.
Yeah, if you want to keep going on this theme, please.
Well, I wanted to keep going on analogy, but shifting. So if people want to follow more closely.
Steve, did you have something
to say?
Yeah, yeah.
What comes to my mind on that about the participation in the divine nature, when he talks, and this is in question 12, when he talks about we are needing a special light to see the essence of God, okay, it's right there that he cites St. John, that we will be like him because we will know him as he is. And the likeness is not knowing him as he is, but he thinks, Thomas says, it's this light by which we know him as he is. And I think the idea would be, we then have something by which we know him, as he does. He has something by which he knows himself as he is, and then we will have something by which we know him as he is. And that's a proportionality, which is also an imperfect version of the same relation, which I think you also need.
Yeah.
And then grace is a kind of a preparation for that, so it's kind of on the way to that. So you can see that as a lesser participation, aimed also ultimately at the divine, the vision of the divine essence. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, so maybe just to push you to potentially moderate the claim a little bit, right? So I'm thinking of the beginning of Aquinas' commentary on the De Habitualibus. So he identifies three, maybe four modes of analogy. And here are three of the four.
Participation.
Of participation, yeah. So so human participates in animal, four term that. A subject participates. A subject participates in its own operation or accident, four term that. And a concrete term participates.
Say the second one again.
So a subject participates in its own accident. And then the potentially fourth one is a concrete term participates in the abstract term, four term that. I think third, right, is
participates in the car.
Yeah. So effect participates in cause, their four term makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
But what are you gonna do with the other ones?
Well, I mean, I'll at least do the one where you have something under a genus term, right? Wasn't that the first one you had? Maybe this doesn't address it, but there is a way in which a genus is like a four-term relation that's collapsed into a two-term relation, right? So we first look at the dog and us, and we call ourselves animals. Now we know that that's univocal, but there behind that there is kind of implicitly this logic. Okay, there's something that is to the dog, like. There's something is to us, and in this case, that has few enough disanalogies that we allow it to be a genus or a species term. The same thing happens in mathematics, right? There's sometimes where you can't collapse the four terms, but sometimes you can. I mean, you could treat 4 is to 6 as 8 is to 12, right? Doing the math quick in my head, right? That's a four term analogy, but you can also treat that as like an equation and reduce it. Like, you're talking about two-thirds. That's just some one thing. But the equation first required you to think about the four parts, and it turns out it's an equality. There are other proportions that you can't turn into equalities. So in geometry, there's some analogy between area and perimeter and volume and surface area. But you can't equate them. But it's helpful if you're learning geometry to think of that relationship.
Can I push on that, though?
Yeah.
I want to push on that a little bit. So if it's true, there will still be a formula that governs all those geometrical figures, right? So you can't reduce it to just an equality, but there's one formula that for whatever it was, the ratio of the perimeter to the area or whatever, that fits all the figures, right? So why isn't that, then, a common species that they all have?
Is there? I mean, first of all, you have to give different kinds of formulas for different kinds of geometric shapes, right?
Oh, is that what you had in mind?
Well, I had in mind just the concept of volume and surface area.
Well, let me pick a much simpler case.
They don't have a consistent ratio.
So if you have, like, a picture of someone, right, and the picture is, like, 3 inches tall, and the real person is, like, almost 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
So obviously the real person is way bigger. But the ratio of the, you know, the length of the face to the side of the face is both in each. So you can say we need four terms here, right? Side of the picture, height of the picture, side of the real face, height of the real face. But whatever, I don't know what it is in real life. 2 to 1, whatever. I just pretend, right? So both of there's this 2 to 1 ratio in the picture,
yeah,
and there's a 2 to 1 ratio. So that looks like a common ratio. Then.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now, but now we don't need four things anymore.
If you're just talking about the spatial relations, right, you could reduce that to something univocal. But then the other aspects of the imaging, you can't reduce that way. And again, that's because in both of these cases, you're talking about a visual presentation that you can. But think about the way in which a song, which you can listen to, can be recorded and encoded as a set of bits and bytes, right, string of ones and zeros. Presumably, there's something on the hard drive,
yeah,
that where the parts of that somehow correspond to every single part of the song. Yeah. But is there a common quality that they both?
No, this seems like a much stronger example than the picture to me, actually.
Yeah, well,
the picture seems to be screaming for. No, but I mean the stock example here is a picture.
Yeah,
but it seems screaming for a reductionistic account that you just gave, but then the other thing.
I don't understand why it's reductionist.
Well, because there's something univocal.
I guess I think probably there's the assumption that there's something always lost in an image, that the image will always be somehow less than the original. I think that's
still be univocal.
I think Aquinas is just counting on that.
I don't know.
This might be a different way of approaching the same kind of issue, but my ears sort of perked up towards the end of your talk when you said that. Something to the effect of, at least correct me if I'm mischaracterizing, it's like we need to get our semantic theory of analogy kind of ironed out before we can be responsible users, as it were, of participation metaphysics or of act and potency and conceiving of division of being in terms of act and potency. Is that a fair characterization?
I think that's fair. I mean, I'm not saying that Thomists have to like put a moratorium on that language and do something else for a while, but I think we have to be careful. Using that language, especially when we're trying to help other people who aren't familiar with it to learn it. And we can't just assert these things and expect them to... It's like, you know, when you're in a foreign country and you just think you can yell louder in English and they're finally going to get through. We might have to, in humility, submit ourselves to a process of translation that will involve some back and forth, where they'll have to learn some of our words, but in order for us to teach them some of our words, we might have to learn some of their words. Is that...
I like that. But I was just going to say that perhaps what we really want here, too, is a good distinction between kind of what type of priority we're talking about. Because, I mean, the reason we need a semantic theory of analogy, it seems to me, is because being is analogical, and it presents itself to us as such. There's degrees in the world. I see grades of perfections. I need a way to talk about it and think about it that's also accurately reflective of reality. And so, you know, the theory, I just think a lot of people get upset with Thomas talking about analogy and fighting about analogy, it seems, because it seems like we have to come up with a mind construct first and then see how it maps onto reality, whereas I think if we were to maybe emphasize that, well, being is analogical, act of potence is really important, let's talk about the way the world is, and then now let's talk about noetic structures we have to talk about.
I think that's right. On the other hand, I think that there are a lot of people for whom it's not obvious that being is analogical. They're so attached to a conceptual framework other than Aquinas's that they can't see that being is analogical. And I'm not just picking on contemporary analytic thinkers here. I mean, as a matter of history, as soon as Occam developed his nominalist theory, he talks about analogy every once in a while just because previous people did, but there's no reason for him to. Right? Once words are just labels for things, and something is either under the word or not, like, you don't have relations of forms or formal concepts, or there's no, like, you don't worry about that. And likewise, you don't worry about an analogy of being or something participating in it. There's just objects out there, and you can collect them into sets or not, but the idea of grades of perfection has no hold either. So it really is, it's not about needing to return to the explicit discussion of semantic frameworks in order to make sense of analogy. It's in order to make sense of the whole metaphysical worldview that would even motivate a theory of analogy. And I just think that's really, really hard to do. If I can plug a paper from my mentor, the second one by Julia Klima, mentioned in that handout, the more recent one, I think does a really, really good job of describing this problem and also trying to take some steps to engage in that project of translation. But it's not just a matter of I found the winning argument. Now everyone's going to be converted. No more Scotists. No more Frege-ians. It doesn't work like that, right? It really is about learning another language, and so that we can help members of that language community learn our language.
Dr. Husel, do you need to depart?
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. Haydn?
I have a question for Father Stephen Brown.
Oh, okay.
No,
is this
wait,
a question
wait,
for Dr. Husel? Yeah.
So I am new to the idea of real semantics. I'm not sure where it plays. I was struck by the Aristotelian notion of, our predication being about forms in things. So correct me if I'm wrong. So I just want to, I think I see a parallel that might be more explanatory than I'm used to, but correct me if I'm wrong. So we signify things because we our mode of signification, I'm going to go there, is based on composition. So we see and describe the composition in things, in predication, which is why we need to deny our mode of signification when we talk about God, particularly because everything we come in contact with is composed, whereas God is not. Is that?
Yes, I think that's the primary thing that motivates the question on divine names, is given that we know that language has this compositional structure, and given that what the main thing we've said about God is that there's no such composition in him at all, and also the other main things we've said about God are mostly negative things that he doesn't have, what are we doing when we continue to talk about God? And I don't think, this wasn't just a problem for Christians. I see the same problem developing in Aristotle's metaphysics. So Aristotle, in Book 9 of the Metaphysics, after he's develop the idea of pure actuality or energeia, entelechia, that doesn't have any dunamis, any potency, any qualification that would diminish it. The last chapter of Book 9 is about how we can have truth about such things, because truth involves the composition in the intellect of subject and predicate. He's asking in the last chapter of Book 9 of Metaphysics the same question that I think is motivating question 13.
Wow. Well,
and that's a good place to end.
Yeah, so
yes.
I have a question for Father Steve Brown. Does sort of logic of evolution contradict the principle that, particularly the principle that the most excellent, or the maximal member of a genus is the cause of every other member?
Everything
of
the genus.
The genus, or even generally, the principle that the efficient cause is always more excellent, or just an act of excellence, containing all the perfections of the effect.
I think I would answer you in two parts. One is, in part, you're going back to the question about animals being more or less perfect. Great. I was trying to argue that that's not really pertinent to the fourth wave, because we're not talking about gradations in animality. you have more, in evolution, maybe you have less perfect to more perfect animals, but not in animality. There certainly is the principle, though, that they need an efficient cause, and you can't get the more perfect from the less perfect. On this one, though, I think I'll punt, because just last week you had a whole seminar, a whole discussion about this, and I'm sure it was more interesting than anything I could say. Why don't you say something about it?
About whether you can get from evolution, you can get more perfect.
Well, yeah. Is that a problem?
Is that what maybe Brian wants to?
Why don't you talk about it? Yeah, you talk about it.
So I gave a talk that touched on this.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. So, but it was very simple. Just, you know, what sometimes gets called the principle of proportionate causality, right? You know, a cause can't give what it doesn't have. You can't get greater perfection from a lesser cause. And the point that I made in the paper last week was pretty straightforward, and I'll just make the same point very briefly now. Which is that however you understand that as a metaphysical principle in Aristotle and St. Thomas, you should try to be careful to make sure that it checks out with the details of their physics and biology. So just to give one example of something that both Aristotle and St. Thomas think happens, they think that the power of the sun and the vital heat caused by the sun that's in the atmosphere is sufficient to educe the forms of certain imperfect animals from just, you know, decaying flesh or slimy mud, right? So, you know, they believe in spontaneous generation. Okay. And that's clearly a case where something more perfect is being adduced, right, from what is less perfect. And the immediate cause, if it's this vital heat, right, it has this power, this, you know, this virtus according to which it can adduce this form that wasn't there before. And in St. Thomas and Aristotle, especially in St. Thomas, this is all articulated in terms of instrumental causality. I think that, I mean, there's a line in the physics where Aristotle says that man and the sun beget man, right? So even the way that they understand the physics and the biology, there's always instrumental higher causality involved in making it possible for things down here below in the sublunary. Right, this is the geocentric cosmology, right? I don't accept any of this. I'm just telling you. Okay. I'm just saying that however
okay,
we understand.
It's okay, it's
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I'm just saying that however we understand those metaphysical principles in St. Thomas and Aristotle, they need to be consistent with the things that they actually thought occurred in their physics and their biology. And I think sometimes if you get a too simple presentation of, you know, why evolution is supposed to be impossible because the greater can't come from the lesser, I don't think that sometimes the way that those metaphysical principles are expressed and are brought to bear is not consistent with things that Aristotle and Thomas think happen in their own biology. If I could give one other example that I talked about mules for a while in the paper. So the other case that comes up is you know, Thomas thinks that the mule, this hybrid species, is sterile. And it's often suggested that he thinks that it's sterile precisely because it's a hybrid of two other species. Well, if you go and look at on the generation of animals in Aristotle, Aristotle proposes that precise argument. He says, maybe the mule is sterile because it's a hybrid. And then he says, that's a bad argument. He says it's a vain and too general argument. It's not attending to the principles of the case. So he gives a different explanation for why he thinks mules are sterile. It has to do with the nature of the horse and the donkey. He thinks they're not particularly fertile species to begin with. They only have singleton births and often have to mate more than once to produce offspring. Okay. So, yeah, so that the other thing, the other reason that Aristotle gives for why mules, why he thinks that general argument for why mules are sterile is a bad argument is because at that point in the work, he's already listed a ton of examples of fertile hybrids. So he just thinks empirically that there are hybrids of, you know, two species that go on to produce other species.
That's really interesting.
Okay.
Sure, but going away from, let's say, the form of a mule or an ox, we talk about qualities such as intelligence, being sensible, being able to move, the power of vision. Mm-hmm. I think, I'm not sure if that shifts the problem, challenge from evolution that it's not that the question is not where the form of the ox comes from, because there's the form warm, but in the process of sort of
new species arising and the power of vision starting to exist among animals, well, you basically have vision from things that not people see, intelligence from dumb things. Does that change the question?
Yeah, so I don't mean to say that what I just said, you know, answers every difficulty that, you know, that might arise about how, you know, forms are reduced, you know, in an evolutionary process. I just mean to say that the way that the metaphysical principles are articulated and the way that they're brought to bear, they have to be consistent with the things that, you know, they think happens. And I want to really focus on, they think spontaneous generation occurs. They think that, and they're animals, right? They're not, it's not just plants, right? It's like animals can be adduced just from this ambient vital heat, right, in the air, right? And the reason it's this special kind of heat is because clearly they did perform experiments where you put like decaying flesh next to a fire and you don't get bugs. And so he says it has to be this ambient vital heat that comes from the sun that can do this. It's not just, you know, it's not the heat of fire that can do it. But anyway, so I just focus on that case, right, where they think that you can have animal forms adduced from something that is not an animal and something that does not have that form.
Three quick points, and then maybe Father Brock will have something to say. But just to follow on exactly that question about vision, one of the scientists at this conference last week said, oh, you know, that's very interesting. They're working on scientifically seeing if you can bring about animate life from inanimate material, which Aquinas did and Aristotle did think was possible. And he said, oh, well, actually, we've discovered that certain chemical compounds are photoreactive. So there is, and what is sight? It's a certain organ that's developing to be much more highly photoreactive. But his point was there are inanimate things which have a kind of sight already. Okay, second point, one of the things that we talked about at the conference as this discussion went on was that perhaps there's a way to think about how these powers or this potency is already, in a way, given in the universe that God has created, so that you just need the material conditions to arise, and then that actuality emerges, or the form is then educed. The last point, what was my last point? I don't remember what my last, so I'll stop there.
No, I just want to add a quick thought. It can't just along the lines of it can't be the case that they think that a univocal predecessor is sufficient anyway. They don't think that, right? That it's enough to explain the existence of these animals that you had animals of the same kind prior to that. You still need a cause of the whole species, sort of, and which they trace back to the heavenly bodies. And in specifically sensation, I don't know about Aristotle, but St. Thomas insist that you can't understand the existence of sensation in things except by the influence of the heavenly bodies, okay? And of course, much all the more so with intellect. That and there he cites Aristotle that it comes in through the door, as they say. So the existence of parents who had intellect is not sufficient, and maybe you say it's not even necessary if you once you see that. Yeah,
that was my third point. That Aquinas does posit the need for another principle for intelligence.
Yeah.
You can't. So evolution and the Church actually formally has taught that doesn't account for the spiritual soul. There has to be another principle. But Dan,
this is maybe a naive. Should I get the mic?
If you speak loud,
just shout.
Okay. This is sort of a naive question. Sort of like a straw poll, but how many of you are like convinced that the fourth way works? if you just read it, I mean, maybe you think the conclusion is true, but do you
think the conclusion is true?
The question is,
I'll raise my hand.
I'm just going to repeat the question for the mic.
The conclusion is true, yeah. But, I mean, especially the tricky premise about the
maximum. So the question is, I guess, addressed to the panelists. How many of us think the conclusion of the fourth way is true? And more seriously, how many of us think it's a good argument?
Can I distinguish before we put up our hands? Well, I mean, there would be a difference between thinking that if it's successful, that it is a demonstrative argument, but having some questions about whether I fully understand its demonstrative force, or thinking, oh, that's a pretty good, I mean, it persuades me, you know, but I'm not able to see it as a demonstration. Do I think that it's a good argument that really fits and in a way is, you know, the best argument, even in a way, the best argument in Thomas's metaphysics? I mean, those would be different questions, and I'm going to put my hand up more or less, you know, for different versions of that. If I don't put my hand up at some point, it's that I think the deficiency is in my ability to understand, not like, oh, it's a bad argument. Okay. So, all right, before we vote, all right. Are we going
to
vote?
I don't even know what to say. Yeah, you want to.
Well, I can get myself out of the way really quickly. I don't really understand the argument. It's really valuable to hear people talk about it in detail. I did hear your paper. It made me realize. and it made me realize I'm now clear on ways in which I don't understand it. So I'm not in a position to be for it or against it. It might be a terrible argument. I don't know.
Yeah, I kind of think it works.
Can we talk about the argument?
Yeah.
More? Is that all right? Because I have a question. Okay. So I'm looking at the handout here. Is that all right?
Yes, please.
So I'm looking at the handout. 1A. We find that in things there is what is more and less good, more and less true, more and less noble, and such like, etc. But more and less are said of diverse things insofar as they approach in diverse ways that which is maximal. Now, you said, I think, that that's not like, that's a conclusion on the way to the ultimate conclusion.
Right.
That's how you read that. Is that right?
No, the conclusion, the first conclusion is, therefore there is something that is most true and best and noble. That's his conclusion. He's got...
Okay.
The minor...
But that almost sounds like the conclusion of the whole argument.
No, the minor is there's more or less, and there's more or less true if you've got a noble. The major is, whenever you have more or less, you've got a maximal. The conclusion is, there's a maximal true...
So that is the thing... Wherever you have more or less, you have a maximal. That is a premise.
Yeah.
Oh, I misunderstood what you said.
Yeah.
Why should I... So I heard your paper in one sense. Why should we believe that? I mean, this in a way was what we were discussing. Why should we believe that premise? Right? Whenever there's more or less... Is it? I mean, whenever there's things that are hotter and colder, then there must be something that's maximally hot. That I'm not sure, but I think that's false. Maybe it's true. I don't know. Maybe...
Well...
100 billion degrees centigrade is nothing can be hotter than that. But I've never heard that.
Yeah, that's a good question. Clearly, I think that question rests on a completely different understanding of the nature of heat from what Thomas understands, right?
Right.
I mean, he thinks of it as a quality.
Right.
Right. We don't really think of it as a quality. What is heat? I don't know. What is heat? It's a kind of motion, right? And that kind of reminds you of his own example of the fat. There's no fastest thing that is the cause of all speeds, of all fast things. And that's because motion is not a perfection. It's a mixed thing. It's kind of a perfection, but it also implies imperfection. You got to trace it back to something which is just perfect, and then it's not a motion anymore. Okay? So you have to really get down to things that just are perfections, and then look at the gradation there. What's the perfection in this, in the case of heat, that we understand to be just a perfection now? I don't know. Is it energy? I don't know. What is it? You'd have to think about that.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if we can't... I mean, there's this general problem when you're dealing with authors like Aquinas, that sometimes they give these examples that are based on science that looks wrong to us. Now, sometimes it's just a throwaway example. It's no problem. Other times you think, wow, these scientific claims are kind of woven together with what the thing that I care about. And then you have to figure out whether you can rejigger the argument. And I'm just,
yeah,
I just can't tell whether this, can we rejigger the
argument
in this case to make the argument work? I mean, I can, in other words, to me, the question is not if medieval science were right, would the fourth way work? But does the fourth way work?
Yeah, I understand. I understand. Does it help if we can come up with other examples? Does that help?
Yeah, depending on what they were, that would be huge.
Like saltier or less salt?
I don't know.
Well, is there anything saltier than salt? Isn't that kind of the question? Or
seems like a weird example, but I can't say why.
More or less wet. Eight.
I don't know.
Or maybe is this better, brighter or darker? There's more or less light in the room. There's got to be a source of light.
But does there have to be something that's Does there have to be something that's sort of brighter than nothing else? The brightest thing that could be? Is that what maximum means?
No, I don't think it is. It's just the brightest. I think he's happy, like as I said, I think he's kind of happy with the local case. This is the brightest in this context.
Okay? Is that all?
You go outside, you see greater or lesser, you see shadows and stuff. There's got to be something. The sun is the cause of it. Now, there maybe is another star which is brighter than the sun, but that's not the point.
But then why don't you end up with the conclusion that there is a being higher than all the other beings? And that's not good enough for a proof of the existence of God.
Why not?
Because there could be a being higher, at least potentially.
Well, not when you realize that let me think about that. There could be a higher.
I mean, God isn't just the best. There's no such thing as a being greater than God.
And you're
if you think there is,
the
you show is, you aren't paying attention.
The point is that it's part of the meaning of God.
Well, I feel like I'm going to get trapped if I say.
Yeah,
this.
I think you are. Yeah.
but okay, I mean, it's metaphysically impossible for anything to be greater than God.
But you can show that in a lot of. I mean, he's the first cause and all the rest. I mean,
but if
he's the cause of all the others.
If I show that there's a being that's greater than every other being. I haven't yet shown that being is such that nothing can be greater than it.
But he's not trying to show that. He's only trying to show that it's the cause of all the others.
Okay.
So, an uncaused being, can there be anything greater than an uncaused being?
So the gradation thing just gets you to the causation thing.
Yeah.
And then the causation thing.
Then you reason from that.
Okay, that's a cool way. Okay, that's a neat way of thinking about
it. You say then that the third sentence in CA, but more and less are said of diverse things, insofar as they approach in diverse ways that which is maximal, is speaking about the cause of their gradation. The maximal must be the cause of their gradation. And if you think about that in a local context, like the light in the room or the candle in the room is causing light on this side and shadow over there,
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, one thing that may help here is what do we mean by maxime, right? And I think all Aquinas means by maxime is parasensium, right? So that which is X through its essence, that's going to be the thing that's maximally X. And then anything that's sub-maximally is going to be X through, not through its essence, but through something else, right? So let's say all of the lights in this room are off and all of the windows are closed, and yet the room is lit. What explains it? Only the fact that the door is open and something else is lit, right? So there's a sense in which it's like derivatively X or non-derivatively X, right? And so if you've got stuff that is derivatively X, it can't just be derivatively X all the way down.
But how is that related to more and less? Because I thought this was the thing you were pushing back against during your paper.
It's not just exemplar.
It's not just... In other words, the more and less business is doing work here.
Yeah, because if you have diverse things, so things of different nature, all of which are derivatively something, then what explains these things of diverse natures that are all derivatively X? There's got to be something that is X non-derivatively.
So to take this back to the example of the animal, the question about animal, there it wouldn't really, that example doesn't work here, because we're not talking about efficient causality of a higher animal with it or something like that.
Unless you bring it back to what I'm saying is about
you see those as particular cases of form,
right?
More or less perfect form. But then you're not in the genus of animal, you're in the genus of form.
That's right, okay.
Okay.
Yeah. David?
This is a different question.
So. Okay, maybe we should stay on this for just a minute. Yeah.
I think maybe the problem with some of those physical counterexamples is it relies on a strict analogy proportionality. Why should we think that the less slow sense is slow in the way the imperfect sense is perfect? What could be more perfect than perfect? But there can be always faster things, right? So there's no strict analogy proportionality, right?
Oh, I see. So you're just denying that speed is a perfection.
Perfect, but I can see how could there always be something faster, right? So that's why I think some of those physical counterexamples don't get off the ground.
Okay, more on this point. Professor Urban in the back, do you want to... speak loudly.
Going with what Father Philippe said, it seems like we can't just have a local principle at work here. It can't just be the case that if you have a certain number of people in the room, some of them are taller and some of them are shorter, and all we mean by that is that someone in the room has to be the tallest. Because that seems not to make sense of Thomas's claim that we're actually saying more and less in reference to him. So if all we mean in even a particular local context is that there's gradations amongst things and one of them has to be somehow the most, just relatively the most, that seems not to do the work that Thomas is trying to do with the principle, because he wants to say that even the very notion of comparison is in reference to a standard that's absolute, and absolute in itself somehow, I think, having what I'm talking about through its own essence is the point there. And that also gets fire better, because in Thomas's cosmology there in his physics, fire actually has heat through itself, right?
It's sure. Elemental. Oh, sure, yeah.
And so that's why these other things, again, this is also why I brought up stickiness earlier. I don't think stickiness actually applies to what Thomas is talking about here, because for Thomas, all of these are importantly things that are both some case where you're going to have an absolute perfection itself causing others, and also cases where all of these things mentioned, being, truth, goodness, and ability, are also transcendental for him. And therefore, there's not going to be anything outside the genus, if you want to put it that way, that can be doing the causal work for the gradation here. So that's what I think the principle of most in the genus is causing the rest has to do. You can't look elsewhere, and the genus isn't self-sufficient, because nothing else in the genus, these more and less, have the same for themselves. So something in the genus, in whatever sense, so it seems to me it works if you take the principle in that sense that Bob is getting up there, as opposed to just a kind of relative maximum in local space.
Can I just say something? I think it's right that it can't be local in the sense that you said, that we've just got something that's the most here. But I don't see why it couldn't be something local in the sense that, as long as it's a sufficient source of itself for that. Our sun is a sufficient source of light and heat. Right, its own nature is enough to explain why it produces light and heat. It doesn't have to be the greatest thinkable bright thing, you know, greatest imaginable, or the greatest hot thing. But I think it's going a little too far to say that Thomas is saying that we think of more or less in relation to a maximum, because he's trying to prove the existence of a maximum from the more and the less. If we had to know the maximum in order to say more and less, we would already be assuming that there's a God in order to say that things are more or less true and good and all the rest. I don't think that's what he's saying.
That's not what this
I think. I'm sorry, I tried to explain it.
We need
okay.
To laugh.
Okay. Yeah. If we're going to stay on this for just take a couple more questions on this and then we'll move on. Yeah.
Mine is a fairly small addendum, but I'll say I think the fourth way is probably invalid as it is, but you can probably rejigger the argument. So this is what I think maybe this suggestion is. So let me just say, I think maybe what the suggestion should go like is if you think that there are transcendental perfections, then you might have something relevant. So the more or less in general wouldn't help, because you get confused about different genuses, and more or less in general doesn't seem to be measured by a maximum. But you could think something like this. Transcendental perfections
are, because they're convertible with being, the way they exist is such that they're participating, right? What you've done now is you've changed the premise, really, to something like an argument for a necessary being, like contingency only exists because of some necessary being, or subsequent causes always exist in efficient causal sequences because of prior efficient causes. That's the only way they have the transcendental perfection they do. But in that case, it doesn't. It would be valid, but it might be presuming too much in precisely the first premise. Yeah. In things, we find that sometimes there are those that are true, good, noble, and you'd have to prove that. But it does seem to me if you switched it to maybe transcendental perfection, you might be able to get a valid argument, but it might be a little question begging or something. That's
yeah. Cool. Yeah, I'm afraid it might be.
Yeah,
great.
Thanks. I'm just wondering if part of the confusion might be it seems like a lot of the counterexamples are coming from contemporary science, and I wonder if part of that is because I think contemporary science is different from Aristotelian Thomistic science is it seems that they're abstracting the qualitative dimensions in their areas of study. So in Aristotelian terms, you can see it as they're studying natural being qua quantity. So just by the very methodology of mm-hmm. discipline, they're restricting Father Brock's notion, the two notions of more or less. They're just automatically restricting the virtues or power notion of more or less, which is the one that he was basing his argument on. So I think that's important to keep in mind when we're looking at some of the examples from contemporary science, of, like more or less hot. Essentially, contemporary science reduces it to the movement. Quantitative movement of particles, so they're automatically restricting the qualitative aspects of it, which is what Thomas is thinking of when he's using E. So maybe that's helpful.
Yeah. Yes, over here.
I heard a proposal once by Richard Swinburne, who I know is the most orthodox Thomist. I don't think he's a Thomist at all, but he made an argument that the quinque via, am I pronouncing that right?
There's
five ways. The five ways are good, more so when you look at them all together. So, like, maybe one of the arguments by itself doesn't stand up, but if you use it as sort of like a supplemental part of the argument, so if it's part of a larger argument that's based on, say, points 1 through 3, then it's still important. I don't know if that's been an idea floated around and discussed about, but that's what I heard.
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, one does encounter this sort of proposal. I mean, the difficulty is it's hard to square with the way that Thomas himself concludes each of the arguments. I mean, each of the arguments concludes, you know, therefore such and such exists, right, which all call God, which we call God, right? So there's not any clear indication. In my paper yesterday, I said in a later article, you know, he says there's a threefold reason why he who is the most proper name. And I said, in that case, I think it is a cumulative argument. It's like three stages in a larger mm-hmm. argument, but I don't think there's any indication in Prima Pars Question 2, Article 3, that's how he's thinking about the progression of the five ways. What I would say about, I mean, insofar as this question is raised, do we think that the fourth way is demonstrative, and what if we don't? Right? What does that imply? Okay. I will make an excuse for why I personally have spent less time thinking about the fourth way, and it has to do with conclusions that I reached in my dissertation work, where one of the things that I did was to trace back for all of the argumentation through question 26 in the Symmetrie Logiae, and for all of book 1 of the Contra Gentiles, to trace back to the conclusions of the arguments for God's existence. Like, how is Thomas actually deriving all of the later conclusions about God? And in the first 26 questions of the Symmetrie Logiae, he only appeals to the conclusion of the fourth way directly one time. And one of the things that I said yesterday is that really, if you just have the notion that there's a first efficient cause, at least in terms of the arguments that Thomas gives, now you have to evaluate each argument. You have to go all the way through all of it. But in terms of the arguments that St. Thomas actually gives, you really only need the notion of a first efficient cause to derive everything else that you say in the first 26 questions. So if you think, and to give another example, he never appeals directly to the conclusion of the third way, and he never appeals directly to the conclusion of the fifth way. So if you don't think that 3 through 5 are valid for whatever reason, that in itself doesn't undercut anything that follows.
Let's change up the subject before we conclude. We've been going on for a little while. David?
Yeah. This question isn't on topic enough. I'm free to ignore it. It is on question 13, Article 8, very particular question.
Can you speak up just a little bit, David?
Yeah, sure. This is a question about Article 8, question 13. I'm just going to read briefly a very brief objection.
Can I touch the screen?
And I'm I offer this question to whoever would
like to answer. Can I touch the screen to check?
The question is the name of God the name of a nature or an operation? The second objection is, a thing is named by us insofar as it is known, but God's nature is unknown to us, therefore the name God does not signify God's nature. So, in the reply, he says, insofar as we can have cognition of the nature of a given thing from its properties and effects, we are able to signify it by name. Hence, from its properties, we can have cognition of the substance of a rock in itself by knowing what it is, or what a rock is. The name rock signifies the very nature of a rock as it is in itself, or it signifies the definition of a rock through which we know what a rock is. So, what I'd like to know is, suppose I was a sort of Lockean fellow who... reading this didn't think, oh, well, that clarifies it. And instead thought, well, that makes substance deeply problematic for me. How do I know even the notion of sensible substance? Because what I know is, per se, objects of sensation, say color or texture. But this doesn't clarify anything for me here. It actually just raises a new problem. How it is that I have any knowledge of what a thing is even sensible?
I guess I would say that insofar as you brought to bear a Lockean sort of concern or a Lockean notion of substance, right? And you think, okay, you know, the sensible qualities, they just don't get me intellectually to a grasp of, you know, the substance. Well, that's actually would be a closer parallel to what Thomas is saying is going on in the case of signifying God's nature without knowing what it is. Because what he's trying to say in that article and in the reply to that objection is that we signify God as the cause of the effects that we know. And so it's important to know that cognition is the broadest possible term for Thomas, right? Intellectual cognition, sense cognition, and all the various kinds, right? Those are all fall under the huge umbrella term of cognition. So if he's just willing to say, he doesn't mean intellectually, but that we cognize God and the divine nature as the cause of the effects that we know in creatures, and it cannot be the case that we reason back from the natures of created effects to a knowledge of what God is in himself. That's the point of the text. So if you happen to have concerns about whether we intellectually know what created substances are, that wouldn't of itself undercut the claim that he's making about the possibility of talking about and signifying the divine nature without knowing what it is in itself.
I think we can take maybe one final question to round out the session. Yeah.
This goes back to a question posed earlier by Father Legge and brings us back to participation. And maybe the relationship between the preambule fide and the articula fide. And I'm thinking particularly of the tertia pars, I think question 2, when Thomas identifies the seventh conveniencia of the incarnation for our furtherance in good as the full participation in divinity. I was wondering if the panel could further relate participation as a philosophical concept of proportional likeness to the more specifically theological category of participation as grounded in the incarnation of the Lord Jesus Christ. Is that a soteriological, let's say, instantiation of the former principle, something different? How do we relate the two?
So the first thing, I think it's helpful... Okay, so we were when Josh Hochschild was here, there was a little... We learned this new slogan. What is it called? Four-term that? Is that how you say it? I didn't feel like that was all settled, right? So I think you can talk about participation for Aquinas without getting into the four-term business, which doesn't mean – I mean, maybe in the end Hochschild's right, but you don't have to say it every time. So that said, I think it's true for – Aquinas that, so to speak, on the natural level, creatures are what they are and do what they do by, now I'm going to do something hand-waving like this, but somehow they share in a partial way in what God is and does. And then that said, it's also true for some creatures that they can do that on a supernatural level. So there's a kind of it is a sort of four-term proportion now between the sort of natural participation, if I can talk like this, and then a supernatural participation. There's a kind of proportion there. I think that's a safe thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
Does that seem right?
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to add, I do think for Thomas, so you know, there's a little bit of a moment there where we had participation is said analogically. That's a line that Josh threw out. But the best instance of participation is really the hypostatic union.
Sure.
I think. And there you have the tightest union of one nature and another in Christ.
That makes me nervous.
And that is sort of taken as a theological prime analogy, as it were, and reference point, and then you have things falling under that, like the light of glory and the beatific vision, and
it's
then the faith, hope, and charity of the wayfarer. And then there's a way in which you talk about natural participation at the other level. What I have in mind is
what
at the end of Favreau's first book on participation, he proposes like kind of a new theory of grace in light of participation. I don't buy it all, but he's got some really sweet charts that actually kind of show it. No, but in all seriousness, by mapping it out like that, he's kind of suggesting there's a great kind of congruence, and there's a key word that emerges in that, which is attingere, which you'll notice comes up in a whole bunch of different places where Thomas talks about the participation reaching a more intensive mode, especially in a theological reality, where it touches upon or actually reaches upon something in a more intensive mode. And so the incarnation is seen as the best instance of this. But then underneath that, there are other types. Like, for instance, in sacramental causality, he'll talk about the grace touching upon the end of what signifies. Sorry, I'm done.
I want to say that some of that Christological stuff there makes me slightly nervous. It's probably okay. As human, Christ has graces and so forth, right? So, and presumably to the maximal degree, right? So I can see there that you could say that he experiences this sanctifying participation to a maximal degree. But more deeply than that, he's just God. So it's just important, and I'm not saying you were saying this obviously, but it's that, and the danger of that analogy just sort of running loose is that you get the idea that the point of the incarnation is that you have a maximal saint. And that's not the incarnation. Yeah, yeah.
If I could throw out...
Yeah, and you weren't saying it was.
This actually is a subject that I've worked on a little bit. So I think Aquinas, well, certainly some of the church fathers will want to say that... I think it's Leo the Great, you know, God became man so that man could become God. Thinking of this in terms of a participation, a divinization of the human nature. And the first sense of that is that Christ's humanity is being elevated up to the divinity in some sense, not to confuse the natures, of course, very importantly. And Leo, of course, would never go along with that. When we talk about our divinization, so Aquinas does talk in the Tertia Pars about our adoptive sonship as being a participation in Christ's sonship, which is natural filiation. So how do you understand what that participation looks like for us? And this is why I was asking Joss the question, because I don't really see the four terms, four terms I feel like just kind of confuses things. But what Aquinas very explicitly does say is that we have a participation on the level of our essence or our nature. That's grace in general. Sanctifying grace in general gives us a participation in the divine nature on the level of our nature. So our nature is elevated in some way. And just as a nature has powers, so our nature has powers of intellect and will, so when our nature is elevated to participate in a higher nature, the divine nature, our powers are likewise elevated and gain a supernatural activation, and that's faith and charity, perfecting our power of knowing and our power of willing or loving. Does that? I don't know if I'm really answering your question, but that I don't really know how to fit that into the four-term thing. But I think he does really see it as a participation. I mean, so participation is very active in his theology of grace.
Yeah.
And it is related to Christ, Christ's grace as an individual man, of course, is a human sanctification of that nature. But there is a participation in Christ's filiation, which is not created. Mm-hmm. And that's insofar as we are made adopted sons. And brought, given now a kind of relation, a proper relation to the Father that we didn't have before, which he gives to us. Okay, but now we're pretty far afield from the subject.
No, it just occurred to me that, no. It just occurred to me, I mean, sometimes he speaks of Christ's humanity as the instrument, as an instrument, right, and all. I mean, and he often talks about how, you know, you need to apply grace and a lot of other things to the ones who have to receive it. You know, you might say that in Christ we have the fourth way, he talks about the approach, more or less approaching. In Christ you have the closest approach to the divinity, right? And then all the others are, none of the others is as close as that, but they all kind of come through that. But
well,
if you think of it in terms of, you know, he's not the, I think it's right to say the point is not that he's the maximal, the maximal
saint. Well, actually,
Aquinas
does very explicitly use an argument very much like this when he talks about Christ's capital grace.
Uh-huh, uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
In the commentary on John's Gospel, he talks about how he's commenting on the line from the prologue of John, from his fullness we have all received.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
So every grace
sure.
is derived to us through Christ because Christ receives the maximal possible grace, which he understands that to be not only exemplary but also efficient.
Oh yeah, sure, yeah. Oh.
So I mean that actually maps very nicely onto what you were saying.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's right.
So maybe on that point we should conclude. Okay, so let's give our panel our thanks.